apostolic Christianity, apostolic history. This is part six. I just like to make a comment about the article that I read about an historian Christianity referred to La Tourette's History of Christianity. I have both volumes one and two that are revised by Ralph Winter. I'm not referring in a great part to Mr. La Tourette's or Professor La Tourette's history. He was the professor of missions and Oriental history at the fellow of Berkeley College and Yale University. And the reason is that there's two volumes. It's rather detailed, and I am doing broad brush strokes of history, very broad brush strokes. And I do not see a whole lot of, it seems to me as an overview that his historical perspective by and large is from the Western Catholic / Protestant European church views, which, okay, there was a significant part of all of that. But I've given some rather general overviews from some other volumes that cover that. But he does have a very extensive, detailed history of Christianity's progress. There's a current also book called By Their Blood from James and Marty Heffley. It's Christian Martyrs of the 20th Century that has a more current history. So this is all part of the apostolics. It's all building on the early foundations. In this final segment, I just felt led to purchase a book, A World History of Christianity, written by Martin Goodman and edited by It was edited by Adrian Hastings, who was, until his recent retirement, professor of theology at the University of Leeds in England. We'll see. What I found in this text that's very interesting is the excellent essays. There's quite a few essays in this book. It's a composite. And I would like to read the beginning essays, which speak of the emergence of Christianity, because it's just so excellent an overview, even from a contemporary perspective of the early church, and all the recent archaeological evidence and things that have come to the surface about New Testament or early Christianity. This is A World History of Christianity, edited by Adriana Hastings. The first chapter is The Emergence of Christianity by Martin Goodman. In the first century of its existence, Christianity evolved from an obscure group of Galilean Jews to become the religion of thousands, most of them non-Jews, in the wider world of the Eastern Mediterranean. Both Christian contemporaries and later generations came to see this expansion as evidence of divine intervention in human affairs. For enthusiasts and opponents alike, it was an extraordinary achievement without close parallel in the religious history of the ancient world before this time. By the Common Era 120, by which time all books now included in the New Testament had been written, Christianity was a clear-cut religion distinct from Judaism, with an already extensive history of its own. Jesus the Jew and his followers lived in the Jewish homeland during the period when it was coming under the sway of the Roman Empire. Thus, the early church was a product both of the late Second Temple Judaism and of the Roman world, and must be understood against both these backgrounds. This is not to suggest that Christianity fitted perfectly into either. On the contrary, the new religion proved in some vital respects unique, and it is by the isolation and appreciation of those unique qualities that its appeal and eventual success can be comprehended. Subtitle. This is from A World History of Christianity, edited by Adrian Hastings, The Emergence of Christianity, Chapter 1, by Martin Goodman, the subtitle Judaism, the Roman Empire, and Jesus. By the time of Jesus, the myth of the Jews about their ancient history were already enshrined in the Hebrew Bible. Jews believed that their people had come to the land of Israel long ago in the time of Abraham. They preserved traditions both about time in the distant past when they had enjoyed political independence and national glory under the rule of the kings descended from their great leader David, and about the calamity in 587 BC when their capital Jerusalem and the first temple built there had been destroyed and most of the people had been carried off into exile in Babylon. Since those days, the nation had grown used to political subservience. The small group which returned to Judea from the Babylonian exile, 537 BCE, did so under the aegis of the Persian Empire, and the demise of the Persian suzerainty in 332 BC was followed directly by the control of new masters, the Macedonian Alexander the Great and the generals who succeeded him. The Jews did enjoy real independence when, during the breakup of these successor states, the priestly dynasty of the Hasmoneans established themselves as high priest in Jerusalem and from 104 BC as kings. But their power, which reached its peak in the first quarter of the first century BCE, was not to last. It was broken by the advent into the region from the west of the ruthless superstate of Rome. The Roman Empire was close to its peak at the beginning of Christianity. It was not by accident that Rome had gained control of the Western Mediterranean world by the end of the 3rd century BCE and of the Eastern Mediterranean in the 2nd and 1st century BCE. The Romans were a profoundly militaristic people led by a deeply competitive aristocracy, and success in war was the main route to political power in Roman society. In the mid-1st century BCE, such competition had led to civil war, by which most of the Mediterranean world was affected. But by 31 BCE, after appalling bloodshed, a single victor emerged. Octavian Caesar, named from 27 BCE by a grateful Senate, and people as Augustus. Augustus was to rule until his natural death in 14 CE, proclaiming throughout his magnanimity, but as a precaution, retaining a standing army of exceptional size and competence. Thus, the Roman world of the last years before the birth of Jesus witnessed the consolidation of the power of a military autocrat over an empire which stretched from the English Channel to the borders of Sudan, in which internal peace was achieved by terror and occasional brutal force. Unification, even under tyranny, had advantages. Although staple food products were still grown locally, the economy of the Roman world was unified to a surprising degree, both through the extraction of wealth by the state and through the efforts of the entrepreneurs who took advantage of secure communications to market between regions manufactured goods of all kinds. The people ruled by Rome had widely different cultures, from Celts to Egyptians, but in the eastern Mediterranean, the Roman state showed a marked preference for the encouragement of urban life on the model first developed in classical Greece. In part, this preference had a political origin in that Rome had no civil service and therefore relied on the cooperation of a wealthy urban elite for such crucial tasks as the collection of taxes. But the effect was a superficial cultural unity so that town centers in one part of the empire looked much like those in another. Thus, whatever the popularity of continuing local languages, Latin and Greek became the lingua francas of a cosmopolitan culture. Within this society, the Jews of Judea were somewhat marginal. Rome had first come into contact with Judea in the mid-2nd century BCE. But the country only came under Roman sway in 63 BC when the great general Pompey captured Jerusalem, ostensibly in support of one native Jewish ruler of the Hasmonean dynasty in his struggles against his brother. The region did not lie in a position of any notable strategic or economic importance for Rome, and the Romans were content to exercise control first through the native Jewish dynasty, and then when in 40 BCE, the last eligible adult male of the Hasmonean dynasty chose to transfer his allegiance to Rome's enemies, the Parthians, to Herod, a half-Jew adventurer from Idumea, a region south of Jerusalem, converted to Judaism by force in the late 2nd century before the Common Era. Herod's family had risen to prominence in Judean society precisely because their low status in Jewish eyes made them unthreatening to the Hasmoneans. Herod himself won his kingdom through the efforts of Roman legionaries in 37 BC and proceeded to rule Judea with an iron hand until his death in 4 BC. The extent to which he relied on repression became clear when, after his death, rebellions broke out all over his kingdom. Thus, his son Archelaus proved unable to emulate Herod's tight grasp, and in 6 CE was sent into exile in Gaul, leaving Judea administered directly by a Roman governor. In Galilee, a different son of Herod, Herod Antipas, continued to rule until 39 CE, and other descendants, including Agrippa, king of Judea from 41 to 44, remained active in the political life of the Jews, but their power was wholly dependent upon the support of the Roman state, and it gradually became standard Roman practice to control all provinces, including Judea, directly through a Roman governor. The start of direct Roman rule in Judea was greeted by a revolt against the imposition of a census intended to ensure efficient collection of the taxes needed primarily to pay for Augustus's standing army. And the relation of the Jews with their Roman governors continued to be occasionally fractious until in 66 CE a general revolt broke out, leading in 70 to the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. Up to its destruction, the temple was a central feature of Jerusalem architecturally, socially, and economically. The importance of the city, one of the greatest of the Roman world, was entirely based on its religious function. For almost all Jews, the sacrificial cult in Jerusalem was believed to be the main form of worship desired by God. In this emphasis on sacrifice on an altar in a temple, Judaism differed little from other religions of the Roman Empire. Jews were strange in the respect only in the instance of most of them that such sacrifices were only permitted in the one sanctuary in Jerusalem, and in the unique custom of mass pilgrimage on special festivals to which this belief led. For other inhabitants of the Roman world, it was obvious not only that the gods would cheerfully accept sacrifices in numerous locations, but also that there were numerous gods. Polytheism was taken for granted, just as people now explain illness in terms of germs, because although they cannot be sensed, their impact can be deduced from their effects. So to the action of the gods could be gauged by what they did. The gods brought prosperity or misfortune as they saw fit. The notion that they might extend the health of humans into an afterlife was rarely entertained, and views about life after death varied greatly. There were, by definition, innumerable gods, certainly more than could be worshipped by any one individual, but this was a problem only for the superstitious. Most people expected to have a relationship only with the gods traditionally worshipped by their communities, and innovations usually came about only at the behest of a previously unrecognized divinity, announced perhaps by a dream or a prodigy. Ancient polytheism was thus inherently conservative and varied according to local custom. Literary attempts to create a mythological relationship between divinities was fairly spurious. This is not to suggest that ancient paganism was static. On the contrary, subtle changes can be observed, not the least at the time when Christianity observed. Thus, inscriptions reveal a greater sense that the gods will behave responsibly and fairly, and there was increased recognition, especially in cities of elective cults such as those of Isis, Mithras, and others, into which an individual could opt in addition to his or her participation in traditional worship. The reasons for the spread of such elective cults were doubtless varied. Adherents could become part of a new community within the wider society. In the Mithraic cult, for instance, devotees pass through various grades of initiation proudly recorded on inscriptions. It is probably significant that such cults were envisaged as having originated elsewhere than in the Greco-Roman environment in which they were now found. Thus, Isis and Serapis came originally from Egypt and Mithras from Persia, even though their worship within the Roman environment entailed essentially a quite different cult from that in their homeland. In any case, the model of the organization of such cults would prove important in the acceptance of Christian communities as religious groups in the city of the empire in the first generation of the church. Pagan writers give a good idea of the ways in which Judaism appeared odd against this background. The Jews had particular ethnic customs, such as food taboos and the circumcision of males, and was found amusing and bizarre, as was the observance of a Sabbath as a day of idleness. But Moravian oppositions were reserved for two strictly theological issues in which early Christians were to follow Jews: the avoidance of images as the object of worship, leading to the accusation, among others, that Jews worship a god of a certain name, and above all, the refusal of Jews to pray to other gods, a refusal that seemed as crazy to polytheists as, to continue the parallel, would a claim by a modern doctrine that all medical ills are due to only one germ. Into this world, Jesus was born in 4 BC or thereabouts. The details of his career and teaching are hard to reconstruct because they were recounted and adapted for ecclesiastical purposes already in the first generations after his death. Hence, the discrepancies in the different versions preserved in the Gospels. I would like to make my comment about this because I really, really see and perceive that if you have the Holy Spirit, you will see that these are four different witnesses, the four Gospels, recounting from their view who Jesus was. And I do not agree in any way with this statement that the teachings of Jesus are hard to reconstruct. I believe what is in the Gospels was in there by the Holy Spirit under direct divine guidance, as it says in Peter, that the Spirit of the Lord came upon them and they wrote as instructed by the Lord. In the non-Christian record, his life passed almost wholly unnoticed. The brief reference by the Jewish historian Josephus to his career, which includes the description of Jesus as a wise man who did remarkable deeds and was a teacher, has been extensively altered by a Christian scribe in the surviving manuscripts. That's opinion of the writer, not necessarily, I believe, valid or not. Nonetheless, some almost indisputable facts, quote, can be deduced from the record by the cautious procedure of accepting as probably true any tradition about Jesus with which the early church seems to have been uncomfortable. This procedure does not require disbelief in the many other earlier traditions about Jesus, only a recognition that they are uncertain. So he put his qualifier in there after sort of bringing doubt into the equation. Thus, it is almost certain that Jesus was brought up in Nazareth of humble origin, but taught and gathered followers first in Galilee and then in Judea, especially Jerusalem. Those followers were all Jews. Some had been previously attached in some way to John the Baptist, an ascetic holy man who encouraged Jews to repent. Jesus, and he, this was so because of the utterly compromised condition of the priesthood at the time of the Second Temple. Jesus himself seems to have been a follower of John before becoming a similarly charismatic teacher. Now, I believe this is totally a presumptuous statement on the author's part. Jesus was the cousin of John and not necessarily a follower. Although, the Gospels say otherwise. Although the precise content of Jesus' teaching was already much debated in the first decades of the church, the power of his personality was accepted by all. His popularity brought him to the attention of the Jewish authorities in Jerusalem, and he was put to death by crucifixion by the Roman governor Pontius Pilate. Such violent death at the hands of the Roman state was not uncommon in the first century Judea, for this was a society under great social pressure with which the political system could deal effectively only with a heavy hand. The reasons for this social pressure were quite complex. In Judea, the main social, economic, and political institution, the temple, was administered by a hereditary caste of priests whose prestige simply by virtue of their role gave some of them political clout and access to a disproportionate share of the wealth which flowed into Jerusalem for offerings and tourism. Well, is there anything different or new under the sun? So it is today. The overall economic state of Judea was prosperous. This was a period of massive public building, especially by Herod the Great, who turned the temple site into one of the wonders of the world. But there is much evidence that disparities of wealth were deeply resented, leading to banditry and class warfare. And so it exists today. Since the local leaders through whom Rome controlled Judea were by definition rich, because it was only to such individuals that Rome handed over power, the ruling class lacked the natural authority which might have enabled them to control their society. In the constant state of low-level ferment which came to a head at the pilgrim festivals when huge and volatile crowds were mustered in Jerusalem, it is uncertain whether these factors had as much impact on Galilee in the north, where Jesus was raised and began his teachings, for there were a few cities in Galilee, and these were very small compared to Jerusalem. Most Galileans were peasants living in villages, and they will only rarely have witnessed the economic and cultural sophistication of the capital. But there is evidence that some Galilean land was owned by Judean priests, and this may explain tensions between landlords and tenants. Although I do have another book called The Ways of the Way, written by a gentleman in Israel and Galilee, who differs with his opinion that in the Decapolis region there were some very large and prosperous cities as Capernaum that were trade routes into the greater Middle East and Central Asia. Israel was in the land bridge between the three continents of Europe, Asia, and Africa. It was the Levant. So I do not believe this gentleman has an accurate view, although Galilee was sort of backwater. Nevertheless, it did have some major cities. It is probable that despite claims to the contrary by some scholars, such economic and social tensions were a greater source of unrest in both Galilee and Judea than in any anti-Roman ideology. Banditry was endemic in parts of Galilee, but there was no serious opposition in the area to Rome, even during the revolt of 66-70 CE. The historian Josephus, who commanded the Jewish rebels in Galilee in 66-67, described the Galileans as particularly prone to rebel, but in the detailed description of his campaign preserved in his autobiography, the Galileans are described as strikingly ineffectual. There was a revolt in Judea, in 6 CE in opposition to the imposition of the census, and a great uprising in 40 in protest against the attempt of the Emperor Gaius Caligula to have his statue erected in the Jerusalem temple. But these revolts were exceptional. Up to 66, the Roman state stationed only a small number of auxiliary troops in Judea, and the province was clearly considered by the Romans to be moderately peaceful. The same economic problem of Judea were prime cause of the growth of an extended Jewish diaspora by the first century CE. Jews left their homeland for a variety of reasons, of which overpopulation is self-encouraged by Jewish opposition to abortion, contraception, and infanticide was only one. Some Jews were carried to Rome and other cities as prisoners after wars, either by Hellenistic kings or by Rome. Others left Judea to find employment as mercenaries. At least some of the Jews in the diaspora were converts or descended from converts. In any case, by the time that Christianity emerged, Jewish communities were to be found in many of the coastal cities of Eastern Mediterranean, as well as in the countryside of Egypt, in the city of Rome, and in rather large numbers in Babylonia. The religion of these widely scattered Jews were very varied, but all pious Jews held to a common core of belief. They all worshiped the God to whom sacrifices were made in the Jerusalem temple. And they all believed that this God had established a covenant between himself and Israel, which was enshrined in the Torah, a term which might sometimes be applied only to the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Hebrew Bible. Sometimes more widely to the whole gamut of divine teaching preserved by Jews through both writings and tradition. There were still debates about the precise limits of the corpus of texts held sacred by Jews, but the central importance of the Pentateuch was universally acknowledged, and the Pentateuchal scrolls were held in great reverence. The prime function of synagogues as local meeting places for Jews wherever they lived was to permit the reading and interpretation of the Torah. Communal prayer was less important, since most prayer was said in private. Judaism was by definition the ethnic religion of the Jews, but one of the most significant changes in Jewish life during the Persian period was the acceptance that any non-Jew could become a proselyte to Judaism simply by adoption of Jewish customs. This custom was an oddity in the ancient world, for no other people is recorded, into which it was possible to enter simply by self-definition. Converts adopted Jewish history as their own and saw themselves as part of the covenant between God and Israel. Acceptance of them by Jews laid open the possibility that Judaism could, in theory, become a universal religion. There is no sign that any Jews in antiquity wished or expected this to happen, except perhaps in the last days. But Jewish proselytism was to provide an important model for the growth of the early church. Variety within Judaism began with different modes of interpretation of the Torah, for like all law codes, the Pentateuch left many issues unresolved. Thus, some Jews, such as the authors of Rabbinic Midrash, tried to make sense of difficult biblical passages by attempting to reconcile them with other passages. Other Jews, like the Pharisees, incorporated common customs into their understanding of texts. Yet others used the additional teachings of specified revered leaders to amplify the text, as in the sectarian writings found among the Dead Sea Scrolls. A very small number referred to only once by the philosopher Philo. And nowhere else in antiquity even claimed that the practical injunctions of the Torah did not need to be literally obeyed, but could be validly observed in their allegorical meaning alone. A belief is widely attested that true prophecy, like that of the ancient prophets of Israel, had come to an end, and it's probable that this explains the common use by authors of religious texts of pseudepigraphic persona in order to give authority to their writings. But this belief coexisted with a claim by many individuals to prophetic style inspiration, which might still lead Jews in new directions. Jews of different persuasions seem to have been remarkably willing to accept such diversity. Records of open breaches between groups are rare and mostly concern the operation of the temple. Even here, Sadducean priests are said to have carried out the temple cult in accordance with Pharisaic procedures, despite their own misgivings. The only truly sectarian group attested in the Second Temple Judaism was a community who produced the Dead Sea Scrolls. Nonetheless, the emergence of distinct groups with identifiable religious programs and, in some cases, distinctive organization and leadership was among the more noticeable of the general trends in Judaism in the time of Jesus. The issues around which these groups clustered also showed distinct features. Foremost among these was the performance of the temple cult in Jerusalem. For all Jews, the correct offering of sacrifices on behalf of Israel was a matter of supreme importance. Doubtless only those who lived near Jerusalem could make the temple the main focus of their everyday religious life. But the temple was, as an idea, was important for all. And such issues as the observance by the priests of the correct calendar and the right procedures for purification was hotly debated. Also, much disputed were the more general theological issues, such as the relationship between fate and free will and the possibility of life after death. While for many groups, physical purity achieved by washing according to various different ablution systems became an important metaphor for spiritual cleanliness. Evidence for these trends is largely confined to Judea, but there are no good grounds for believing that the Judaism of Galilee was markedly different. It is probable that some Galilean Jews were descended from those Gentiles converted by the Hasmonean Aristobulus in 104-103 BC. But there was no reason why their generic origin from three generations earlier should have affected the Judaism of the Galileans of Jesus' day. Galilean Jews came on pilgrimage to the temple where they could, but presumably not three times every year, as in theory they were required to. Some customs, for instance, with regard to financial arrangements within marriage, were different in Galilee from Judea, and it is possible that the admiration, according to the pious Galilean holy man, Hanina ben Dosa, who was strikingly unconcerned about issues of purity, which concerned many other Jews, was a distinctive element of the Judaism of the region. But in general, the distinctions between Galilean and Judean Judaism were minimal. The same is probably true of diaspora Judaism. Diaspora Jews in the Mediterranean world spoke and thought in Greek rather than in Hebrew, and treated the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible, as a sacred text in its own right. But there is little evidence that diaspora Jews syncretized their religion with the pagan cults around them. On the contrary, their position as minority communities in diaspora cities may have encouraged them to stress their differences all the more. Gentiles who became proselytized to Judaism will have been attracted precisely because Judaism was different and bizarre, not because of its similarity to the religions they already knew. There is no reason to suppose that the highly sophisticated allegorical interpretation of the Torah to be found in the philosopher Philo, the only Jewish theologian of this period whose writings were extensively preserved by early Christians, was typical of diaspora Jews. All Jews believed that history progressed under divine guidance and that it was moving towards an eventual culmination. In the time of Jesus, speculation on the nature of that end was rife, and the views expressed were very varied. The precise dating of the extant eschatological writings by Jews from this period is very difficult, but it is probably significant that some are in the form of apocalyptic, giving the impression that the nature of the future had been divinely revealed and was thus beyond dispute. Many thought that the last age would be ushered in by cataclysmic disasters and great wars in which Israel would triumph over her enemies, followed by a time of bliss in which the land would be the center of a holy kingdom blessed with supernatural prosperity. Speculation centered on the future of the Jews, on the eventual fate of Gentiles' views, differed widely, some claiming that they would be destroyed, others that they would be attracted to the Jewish God or even converted to Judaism in the New Age. The role in all of this of the messianic figure also varied greatly. In some depictions of the eschaton, no reference was made to a leader of any kind. Some Jews look forward to a political leader of the line of David, others to the advent of a supernatural heavenly figure, yet others to more than one Messiah. Nor was there agreement as to how imminent the Messianic age might be. Some Jews seem to have believed that they were on the threshold of the last days. Others that this was something to which they could look forward in the distant future. Thus, the Messianic faith was integral to almost all types of Judaism in this period, but it is unlikely that it dominated the religious life of more than a few. Of all the known Jewish movements of the first century, only one, Christianity, was defined by its messianism. How were the life and teachings of Jesus viewed by Jews accustomed to such varied forms of their religion? The Gospels themselves give only a partial answer, since they were composed at a time after Jewish rejection of the Christian message was already widespread. But some plausible suggestions are possible. Jews will have seen Jesus as a holy man from the rustic region of Galilee, whose prophetic inspiration was confirmed by his power to heal the sick and to predict the future. The performance of miracles gave authority to his teaching despite his minimal learning. His utterances in turn gained force from references to the imminent kingdom of God, probably a reference to the last days, encouraging some of his followers to see in him the long-awaited Messiah. According to the Gospel accounts, Jesus taught an idiosyncratic interpretation of the Torah, showing leniency in some areas and strictness in others. But none of his ideas would have been incomprehensible or outlandish to his fellow Jews. Thus, for example, he taught that the laws of the Sabbath were to be interpreted leniently, and that contemporary concerns over physical purity were not important, but that laws against taking an oath in vain were to be taken with exceptional seriousness, and that marriage agreements were too important to be set aside by divorce. Similar disputes on such matters between other Jews in this period are widely recorded, so it would be wrong to see Jesus as marginal within Jewish society on account of the views he propagated. On the other hand, something in Jesus' behavior was to lead to his crucifixion by the Roman governor with the approval of the high priest and his entourage. If Jesus was as charismatic an individual as he is described in the Gospels, drawing crowds by his oratory and his powers to heal in a fashion dangerously close in the eyes of others to magic, it is not surprising that he drew upon himself the hostility of the political authorities as John the Baptist had done before him. Thus, it is very hard to envisage a theological reason for Jesus' eventual crucifixion, since nothing he was alleged to have preached was more shocking than is found elsewhere in Jewish literature of this period, whereas a political explanation is easily forthcoming. The Judean ruling class, led by the high priest Caiaphas, knew that their control of the Jerusalem crowds was shaky. Above all, at the time of the pilgrim festival of Passover, when the city was packed, they had few troops, but their political position depended on their success in opposing their authority, for the Roman governor could and did replace high priests at whim. When a Galilean appeared with a crowd following him, it might seem an act of political prudence to have him put out of the way. Now, let me state that this gentleman who wrote this article, Martin Goodman, is a professor of Jewish studies in the University of Oxford. He is a fellow at Wolfson College, a fellow of the Oxford Center for Hebrew and Jewish Studies, and a fellow of the British Academy. He has published widely on both Jewish and Roman history. So the gentleman does know academically what he's talking about, and we can derive a great deal of truth or facts from his narrative here. I will continue to read the emergence of the church.